This episode contains depictions of violence that some may find triggering or disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Oh my god, look at the little mocktail that I made for myself.
Cute.
Yeah, right? A little rosemary, some strawberries.
Very nice. Here it is. Here's the noise.
Mr. Graham is home, officially.
He is. Where'd you go? What'd you get? He got me enchiladas.
Oh, yum. I love enchiladas.
Oh, I'm like hot now. I'm just like, that's so nice.
It's so nice when they take care of dinner, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Very
love your shirt,
so.
By the way.
Thank you, it's Graham's.
It's cool.
Venom shirt. Did I get you the Venom shirt or did you get it for yourself? I got it. That's what I thought. I got it for him and now I wear it.
Oh wow. So we're back.
We took a little spring break.
Yep, just a teeny one. Just because of technical difficulties, life difficulties, but we are excited to be back. You have paranormal this time around.
I do. I have something that is, was all invested in sharing it. I did all my research, and then I was like, hey, I'm going to get a little bit more. And there really isn't much more, so it's short and sweet, but it's a good one.
Okay. All right, cool. Mine might be a little short and sweet as well, but...
Perfect.
Yeah.
I think it's the first time we've both had it. Like, usually one of us is, like, a little short and sweet, and the other one has one that's a little bit longer. I mean, it's not that short. I don't think.
It's not, like, 5 minutes, like...
No.
Once upon a time. The end.
No, like, normally I've got maybe, like, 5 pages of notes for mine, and this time I think it's 3.
Ooh, okay.
And there's a picture, so maybe 2.5. That's good. It's good.
Oh, awesome. I love it. Can't wait. Oh, I do believe we have some Patreon members to shout out though before we get into it.
We do. We have quite a bit. We have Lena Kitty. And cute. We have AJ.
Welcome, AJ.
And this one, I'm assuming it's Bree. Okay. Please let us know if it's pronounced differently. It's B-R-E-I-G-H. So I'm assuming. Bree,
yeah,
like Lee. Bree.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And then we have, I think they put like the whole name, but sorry, Alicia.
Alicia or Alicia?
Yes. And Faye.
Welcome, Faye.
And we have so many. Judy,
thank you so much, Judy.
Britt.
Hello, Britt.
This one, I am so sorry. It's spelled Zdenka.
Zdenka?
It could be. Zenka? I'm not as familiar with that kind of pronunciation. So please let us know because we'll reintroduce you with the correct pronunciation. And then we also have Naomi.
Yay, Naomi.
And Christian.
And thank you, Christian. Welcome, everybody. My gosh, that was a long list.
That was a long list. I feel like someday we're going to have to make like a virtual welcome as well.
Yeah.
Not just on here, but like in our posts to make sure y'all know you got your shot out.
Yes, definitely. That would be good. But yeah, we're so appreciative of each and every one of you. It's honestly very, I don't know, it's just amazing just the amount of people that have been signing up for Patreon, wanting to support the podcast. We really do appreciate it. It helps us out immensely. And yeah, for anyone who's interested in Patreon, if you're listening, you're like, what's Patreon? So you can become a patron of the podcast for as little as $5 a month. We have different tiers, but some benefits that are exclusive to Patreon members include bonus monthly episodes. Some tiers include a reading with Laura. We also post some other like kind of seasonal goodies, as well as you're added to our close friends list on Instagram, and you get access to our private Facebook group. So you can connect with other listeners of the podcast, as well as us, because we're also a little active on there. Like we mostly like respond or will comment on posts. We kind of let our patrons post whatever they want, but we're on there. We are the moderators there. So definitely check that out. If you're interested, that's patreon.com/thenewwitches.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. And with that, you ready to get into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
Cool. You go first.
Don't we do true crime first?
Oh, wait, you're so right. In my head, I like forgot that I had true crime.
I was looking at the title. I'm like, wait a second. Did you do paranormal too?
One of these days that will happen where we both do the same, not mm-hmm. the same topic, but the same like genre. Yeah. And it'll be great. It'll be fun. today I am covering, you know, it's been a while since we've had a cult. Mm-hmm. And so today I'll be covering Synanon. Have you ever heard of it?
It's an offshoot of Cinnabon, correct?
I wish.
It's a mixture of Cinnabon and QAnon?
So something like that? It's like a spinoff of Alcoholics Anonymous. This was a kind of sobriety group that started.
Oh.
And it's spelled SYNANON, so Sin Anon. And so this, the genesis of this group, so like back in the 50s and before, anyone who suffered from substance abuse, they pretty much like, there wasn't like a big treatment plan for them. Mm-hmm. Like they could go to the doctor, but there wasn't like rehab facilities like there is now. And pretty much if you were like a drunk or you did drugs or whatever, and you like got, you know, got into crime, you were just basically thrown in jail. Mm-hmm. That was pretty much where if you didn't end up dead, you would end up in jail as a substance abuser. And Synanon actually changed that. They really did. They weren't the very first rehab. They were not. But they were able to convince the American public that addicts could actually be saved. Like their marketing was, I mean, we'll get into it. Synanon really changed all that. So it really pioneered the idea of the ex-addict as becoming like a drug counselor. So past being a sponsor, then they're like kind of leading a group. It was also kind of pioneering of tough love therapy, and it invented a culture of recovery to replace the culture of street junkies. Mm-hmm. So like many cults, the beginnings were rather like genuine, sincere, like well-intentioned, and we'll see as time goes on that things kind of turn a little sour. But members of Synanon actually
went on to be key players in establishing numerous like rehabs, like drug treatment centers, therapeutic communities. Some of the members of Synanon went on to found Tomb Est in Venice, Delancey Street in San Francisco, Amity in Tucson, Phoenix House in New York City, and Daytop Village in Queens, New York. And graduates of those programs would go on to start their own facilities, carrying with them traces of like the nugget of what Synanon was. Mm-hmm. So Synanon was actually pretty revolutionary as far as really launching the substance abuse rehabilitation industry, treatment centers, such. So if you can believe it, it started in Santa Monica and actually would migrate over to Marin County. Like, it's actually this now is right in our back door.
I feel like any sort of rehab that has gained any sort of name for itself, it does not surprise me that it started in Santa Monica. But I mean, and then going to Marin, for anyone who doesn't know, yeah. California, Marin is I don't want to use
bougie.
Yeah, there you go. It's bougie. It's very, I'm too good for San Francisco, but I'm very wealthy.
At one point, it was the fourth most expensive county to live in the nation.
Yeah.
The world. No, just in the U.S.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's still in that like standing, but I think it's consistently one of the top 10 most expensive counties to live in.
Yeah. I mean, if it's not in that same spot, it's not because they changed. It's because others popped up. They're the same. They're
still bougie AF. Yeah. For sure. But so this actually launched in Santa Monica. So enter Charles Diedrich. I should have looked this up. I always want to say Diedrich, but I'm going to say Diedrich.
How's it spelled?
It ends with a C-H. It's D-E-D-E-R-I-C-H. Okay. So I just looked it up and it's Dederick.
Okay.
But that's per howtopronounce.com. And it actually was his name, Charles Dederick. Mm-hmm. Like they had him cataloged in there. So that's just what I'm going to go with.
Perfect.
I've definitely heard podcasts like in my research about him, but everyone kind of pronounced it different. So I'm not super sure which one, like how he would pronounce it. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to go with Dederick because that's how pronounce.com told me to do it. Anyways. So yes. So enter Charles. He also went by Chuck sometimes. Dederick. Mm-hmm. It's 1958. And he launched it, like, it was just like this Santa Monica, hold on, sorry, like my notes are kind of actually out of order. One moment. Okay, sorry. Okay, so Charles Dederick was actually a college dropout, and he was an alcoholic. He bounced from job to job. He married and divorced, several times. And according to an oral historian documenting Synanon's short history in 1962, Dederick called it, quote, the most important single experience in my life. And this is referring to, he was actually part of the study where he basically like took LSD.
Okay.
And he's like, from this moment on, it was like one of those like experimental studies. Mm-hmm. He's like, from this moment on, he like tried LSD and it changed his life. Mm-hmm. He had kind of this this experience where he just, I don't know, understood life, I guess, as far as what he thought. So after this acid experiment, so he did that in 1957. He was actually 1 year sober at the time. And afterwards, he became a super voracious reader of philosophy and psychology. And he was a huge fan of Self-Reliance by Emerson, and also utopian notions put forth by Thoreau and Skinner. Dederick was living on $33 a week unemployment checks, and he was going to AA, but he began to taper off after that LSD experiment. He was also known for being extremely, like, he was a great oral, like, public speaker. Mm-hmm. Like, in those AA meetings, he would go on and on.
An orator.
And people were very...
An orator.
Orator, thank you. I'm like, what is that word? Yes, an orator. And people would just be so enraptured. Because he spoke about things in a very philosophical way. He would talk about himself, of course, but he just had that kind of charm that makes for a perfect cult leader, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So he went from one AA meeting to, like, he was going on almost a nightly basis. Not only because it helped him, but he actually got really hooked on the attention and the power that he had in his public speaking. But he began to taper off, and he was, like, only going every other night. And he said, that's all I did. I was the first one to speak, and I'd speak all the night unless they stopped me.
I can already tell this is the makings of something. Though I will say, for some reason, my TikTok has decided I need to see people telling their ketamine stories, people going to ketamine therapy.
Oh.
Borderline has me interested. I wouldn't qualify, and I don't actually know that I'd want to do it, but look up people's stories. I'm not surprised that he had an epiphany after experimenting with LSD.
Yeah, LSD, I've heard that many times, or like shrooms or like psychedelics.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely tend to give people. I mean, we have a friend that after he did shrooms, like, he was never super religious and suddenly had a huge spiritual awakening. Mm-hmm. Not that he's religious, but he's just very spiritual now. Mm-hmm. And now he just loves everything mushrooms. And he doesn't even have to be a psychedelic mushroom. He just loves mushrooms. He's such a cool guy.
He's a fun guy.
He is a fun guy. Laura with the jokes. That was good. Okay, so... a little more about Charles Dederick. He wasn't one for learning or working. Like, he wasn't good at school. Again, he, like, dropped out of college. He kind of was one of those people who had a chip on his shoulder. He spoke in a growl and was overweight, and the right side of what's described. His face is often described like looking like kind of like a bulldog. Mm-hmm. But the right side of his face actually drooped from a near fatal bout of meningitis that he had at 29. Anyways, so he landed in Monica at 40. His second marriage was, you know, on its last legs. He was struggling for 3 years. And, you know, eventually he did find his way to Alcoholics Anonymous. He was able to get sober. And that's when he got hooked. In 57, there is the acid experiment that really changed his life. He began tapering off from AA. And what happened once he stopped going to the AA meetings is, again, he was an orator. Like, he was super charismatic. People loved him. And when other recovering alcoholics checked up on him, Dederick would throw, like, impromptu meetings. Like, he'll be like, oh, like, let's meet. And he would just lead his own kind of meeting. And it would be not so much styled like an AA meeting. Like, it was supposed to be for those trying to recover from substance abuse. Mm-hmm. But it was much more like symposium, or like kind of like a group therapy sessions, and they could actually get rather combative. And he was so popular to lead these get-togethers that it actually ended up happening 3 times a week at one point. Like, it started becoming a three times a week thing where he would lead these impromptu meetings. And again, most of these people who are joining the meetings were alcoholics or recovering alcoholics. At this time in history, Narcotics Anonymous was a thing, but it wasn't like as organized as AA was. Mm-hmm. And so drug abusers didn't really have much of a place to go. Like, NA wasn't as big at this point. Mm-hmm. Or well known, or, you know, I don't think like offered. Like, I don't think there was enough like places that offered that. And so eventually, this young man named Whitey Walker, he was a heroin addict. He was fresh out of prison and he joined the group and he loved it. And so he started inviting his other quote unquote dope fiends, is what he referred to them as, to come to these meetings. And what was already quite like a tough love symposium, like, again, I use the word combative, these kind of group therapy sessions that Dedrick was leading, mm-hmm. they started becoming much more aggressive. Just because, like, Whitey Walker and his friends were a much more savory type of people.
Right.
As you could imagine. Mm-hmm. But Dedrick actually like loved this. He loved how like intense these sessions were getting. And these sessions became known as Sin Anons. So no one is super sure of how Sin Anon, like the word, came to be. Some people think that obviously it's a play off of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Right.
And sin, S-Y-N, being like togetherness. So coming together, because he was bridging that gap between Alcoholics Anonymous and those who were, you know, trying to recover from drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But another story goes that one of the participants was trying to pronounce symposium and crossed it with seminar, and he was also slurring because he showed up drunk with and he like a mix of symposium and seminar and anonymous, and it came out as synanon.
So that makes so much more sense to me.
He would
see it as a seminar that he was leading, I'm sure.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that one makes a lot of sense. Like, it could totally be bogus, but it makes a lot of sense if that's how it began. And, you know, Dedrick really, like, connected with these people. He was sober himself and wanted to help others get sober and be kind of like that big brother to these people. Mm-hmm. He started letting them crash on his couch. You know, they were trying to like detox from heroin. And even though these addicts were like full on adults, it wasn't like a bunch of kids. A lot of them, though, called him dad because he was like very nurturing, always like was there to support them and help them get clean. And so these synanons were held in Dedrick's apartment. But eventually these got so popular, the group got too large for his little apartment. That's when he started leasing a storefront, a dingy storefront in Ocean Park in Santa Monica for $100 a month. The same year, in 1958, the group incorporated as a nonprofit. So things are getting legit now. This is no longer mm-hmm. just a hobby group or anything. Like, this is getting serious. And as you can imagine, Dedrick was a little bit of a narcissist.
You're kidding.
He thought a lot of himself. He thought this innovation for, like, no one was doing this kind of, like, group therapy style, because The synanons, not only was it like in AA or NA where you get up and you kind of, you say your piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, it had that combative aggressiveness. It was like a cathartic experience. So people would like yell at each other. They would try to get the anger and the anguish that they had out. Mm-hmm. But it would get, honestly, like, as you can imagine, borderline toxic. Because then it would start towing the line of like verbal abuse, like of everyone kind of throwing right. verbal abuses to each other. But he thought that this was a genius innovation because as far as he could see, he was helping guys get clean and gals, I'm sure, people get clean. And they were staying clean. And they were all like just eating up every word that he had to say. He actually was... I guess quoted saying that he predicted that Synanon would become as famous as Coca-Cola.
Oh.
Like he thought he reinvented the wheel. Truly. No, that he invented the wheel is kind of like
right.
how he saw it. Unfortunately, the city didn't really agree. They weren't big fans. Inspectors declared the building wasn't up to code and had it bulldozed. So Dedrick moved his group, at this point it was about 65 members, to the old National Guard Armory building in on the beach in Santa Monica, which, you know, the neighbors of that, you know, spot weren't a big fan of.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 days after moving into this new place, Dedrick and three other Synanon members were arrested for treating drug addicts without a license and, quote, operating a hospital in a residential zone, unquote, according to the Los Angeles Times.
Oh.
And Dedrick is quoted saying, apparently, we started saving lives on the wrong side of town. And he was sent to jail for 25 days. What this did, though, it did not hold Synanon back. If anything, it turned Charles Dedrick into a martyr because people were seeing like this guy who was opening up his heart and his home to these addicts. He was helping them get clean and then he's being punished and thrown to jail for it.
Right.
And the media loved it for a, like 10 or more years after that moment. The media loved Synanon. Early on, the Los Angeles Times ran a two-part feature on the group. The Los Angeles Mirror published a four-part series, a 14-page photo spread in Life magazine, hailing Synanon as, quote, a tunnel back into the human race, end quote, was followed by a glowing write-up in Time magazine, which repeated Dedrick's dubious claim that 80% of addicts treated by Synanon stayed clean. That was not true. But imagine that's reading that in Time.
That's a hard statistic to even get. I mean,
right? Like, how do you even track that?
They're not around long enough. Yeah, I would have called bullshit if I were alive then.
I mean, but if you're a person reading about this guy and his group in Time magazine, and he's already getting like positive media through other publications. And you read that, you're like, oh my God, this guy has figured it out. And reporters also loved Dedrick. He was really good at just, he was very eloquent and he was very quotable.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a fun fact. He is actually credited with coining the term or the saying, today is the first day of the rest of your life. That's what he would say to like his new members of Synanon. He also, his like philosophy, it was interesting. His philosophy, like he was also quoted saying, crime is stupid. Delinquency is stupid. And the use of narcotics is stupid. What Synanon is dealing with is addiction to stupidity. That's what he told the New York Times.
Okay.
I'm like, okay, I think right there, that would flag, that's a red flag right there. Because I'm like, addiction is a disease, and you clearly don't understand that if you're calling your people being like stupid. Like, it's just
right.
But back then, I don't think we understood
people
addiction.
Were stupid.
I don't think we like widespread understood addiction as, you know, a disease.
No.
It was just kind of like a flaw, a weakness.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
So Bill Lane was a 20-year-old junkie living in Brooklyn with his mom, and his mom heard about Synanon on TV. And as I said, there was no such thing as like drug rehab in those days. I mean, if you got busted, you went to prison. Like, that was it. Mm-hmm. There was no like program to try to rehabilitate you.
Right.
And so he arrived at the Santa Monica compound in 1962 with no money. And when he got there, he said, I was sick. There was no medication. You kicked on the couch in the middle of the living room. I just got caught up in what was going on. In all honesty, I loved it. I had a fabulous experience. It saved my life. So a lot of jazz musicians were members of Synanon. So every Saturday night, Synanon threw a huge party open to the public with a jazz band. And it's like, okay, these are addicts, so these are people who like know how to party. Obviously, they were like dry parties, mm-hmm. but they know how to like throw a party and have a good time. And at the time, it became like one of the biggest things in LA. Like, everyone wanted to go to the Synanon parties, even if they weren't part of Synanon. Like, it was open to the public. It was a great way to get like the word out there and to try to like hook people, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the core of Synanon was the Synanons, those like sessions.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, the group has developed. It's now called Synanon, but they don't refer to those sessions as Synanons anymore. It started being known as games, or simply the game, because members would sit in a circle, call people out on their secrets, their hypocrisies, their dishonesties. It was that like combative aggressiveness. And they would hold a game, quote unquote, the game, at these parties to kind of show people what they were all about. And while you think that would keep people away, like, what the fuck? They're like being so mean to each other. Mm-hmm. People were just so fascinated by it. I mean, even Betty Dederick, who would become Charles Dederick's wife, she was an addict herself. And she said, I was terrified by them, fascinated by them, enjoyed them, hated them. I just ran the whole gamut of emotions with those damn things. So it was almost like a thrilling experience. Again, there was that catharsis. Because if you participated, not only were people unloading like kind of like their anger and angst on you, and their frustration, but mm-hmm. you got an opportunity to unleash that as well.
That's also like, I mean, psychologically, that's a form of control, like a social control.
Right? Because it's kind of like making the members implicit in the abuse. Right. Like, it's not just coming from Charles Dederick. Like, everyone is participating in it. It's the status
exactly.
quo.
And it's all about humiliation mm-hmm. and people being pushed to find someone's their weaknesses and exposing them and just
mm-hmm.
I feel like there's a term for that as like a particular form of abuse, but
yeah,
fun therapy.
So this was definitely, you know, kind of a spinoff of attack therapy. Now, I'm not going to write off attack therapy because there have been articles that write about when it is effective. However, it is effective for a niche group of people. You have to be suffering from specific things and your mindset has to be in a very specific place for you.
I was going to say, like big in the kink community?
Well, I mean, perhaps, but no, it was like if you thought too much of yourself, or if you kind of like were in denial of things that you do need corrected, that tough love or quote unquote attack therapy could be beneficial to a person with that kind of mindset and self-image. But people who are broken have a very negative self-image of themselves, which honestly is the majority of these people at Synanon. While there is catharsis in it, it's over time actually very damaging and breaks that person down. Big surprise. So Betty, she was originally Betty Coleman, and she became Charles's third wife. But her first encounter with Synanon was in 1959. And at the time, she was a prostitute and she was a junkie as well. And she had never been around other addicts in that way. Like it was, she was like, it was a weird scene. I got caught up in it. But it was so fascinating because I think it was the first time that you actually could connect with junkies that all wanted to get better. Because again, like NA wasn't a huge thing at this point. U.S. Senator Thomas J. Dodd declared that Synanon could, quote, lead the way in the future to an effective treatment for not only drug addicts, but also criminals and juvenile delinquents, end quote. And social scientists actually also like went to see for themselves, like, oh my gosh, like, let's find out about this new method. And Hollywood got on the Synanon train as well. They created a film in 1965 called Synanon. And it starred Edmund O'Brien as Charles and Eartha Kitt as Betty.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So 10 years after its beginning, Synanon boasted at least 1,100 members and was receiving $2.5 million a year in donations. It had $7 million worth of real estate in Santa Monica, West LA, San Diego, San Francisco, Tamales Bay, Reno, Detroit, New York City, and Puerto Rico. It owned a number of gas stations and ran a $1 million a year specialty advertising business that sold pens and office supplies with the Synanon logo stamped on them. And salesmen pretty much were telling Fortune 500 companies to buy from Synanon and save a life, basically saying like proceeds to this go towards helping us, you know, house all of our different members and offering our services to them. So yeah, I mean, again, this thing started off in a positive note and it really, really took off. And there's actually this guy, Phil Ritter, that he actually entered one of the Bay Area branches of Synanon as a non-addict, or what's termed as a square. That's what they called people who were non-addicts but wanted to kind of be part of this group.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's like, you know, it started in the 50s, but it went into the 60s and 70s. Like, it was the prime time for, I mean, that's why there was a lot of cults around this time, because it was
right.
Alternative lifestyle. Everyone had an open mind. New age was big. And so anything that was out of the norm but still seemed sort of effective, people were super enthralled by it. So when Phil Ritter entered the Bay Area branch of Synanon, he said, quote, there was a lot of drugs around and a lot of negativity. But when he joined, he sold his car, moved into the 8-story Synanon building in downtown Oakland, and shaved his head, which had become a practice that was at first just a punishment and a way to haze newbies. But then was kind of...
Oh, they did hazing.
Yeah,
okay,
they
good.
Did hazing, right? Isn't that great? But at that point when Phil Ritter joined, it actually was the norm. So even past being a newbie, people would keep their shaved heads.
Was there a purpose to having shaved heads?
No.
Just an identifying thing?
It was just kind of like an identifier. Like, yeah, it began as just like a phasing thing. And it just kind of stuck because they felt like, ooh, it's like my badge that I'm Synanon. I have a shaved head. Mm-hmm. And actually, many Synanon members would appear with shaved heads as extras in George Lucas's dystopian science fiction film, THX 1138.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
And Phil ended up working as a mechanic at a Synanon-owned auto repair shop, and he made $50 a month. But he was just like so happy to be there.
Right.
But Synanon's mission started changing. In 1969, the organization dropped the goal of graduation. From then on, addiction could be treated only by keeping addicts close. So, Synanon began to welcome non-addicts like Ritter, and Dedrick suggested that he was, quote, getting out of the dope fiend business, unquote. He created the Punk Squad, which was like a boot camp devoted to disciplining juvenile delinquents sent to Synanon by their parents on the courts. Like, this is how, like, enthralled people were. Like, people were sending their children, and courts were assigning them to go to Synanon.
Run by an unlicensed person.
Yep. And the organization began marketing the game as, you know, this great new therapy. This innovation. It rebranded itself in the 1970s. So, again, this started as a drug treatment program and then became a psychotherapy program to attract middle-class people with this intriguing Synanon game. So by the early 1970s, about 3,400 squares, those non-addicts in California, New York, and Detroit were paying cash to participate in the games. Again, this was the heyday for the human potential movement. Americans were, you know, starting to open up to therapy a lot more. There was New Age. There was religions like the Divine Light Mission, alternative communities like Esalen, and cults like the People's Temple, and then Synanon. And many of these things began in California. Big, big surprise. Dedrick would often say Synanon was an experimental society. Or as he put it when he was deposed later on by Paul Marantz, who he'll come in later again in a bit. It was an ever-changing group with ever-changing goals, thrusts, directions, and so on. So Dedrick moved to Marin County, and he started wearing overalls and thus spread that trend. Now everyone not only had shaved heads, they were also wearing overalls. And it was that attire was basically all but mandatory at that point. And when Dedrick quit his 3-pack-a-day habit in 1970, he was quite the smoker, he basically decreed that everybody else would quit too. And that was actually a decision that had financial benefit because Synanon had been spending $250,000 a year on cigarettes to provide for its members. So they just saved like $250,000 by making everybody quit smoking. And an even better financial benefit came in 1974. The organization was granted religious status by the federal government.
Of course. Yeah. Of course they sought that out.
So with this kind of money, at this point, Dedrick had very, very good attorneys that helped him basically just... How can he save money and how can he protect what he has going on in Synanon and keep it going without anyone cracking down on him, right? And of course, there was the tax advantage. Being a religion might mean Synanon wouldn't need to be licensed. And there's the tax advantage. He also pointed out that it would eliminate a number of silly questions such as when do they graduate and why do they have to obey? Nobody graduates from a religion. And that's a quote from Dedrick's head attorney, Dan Garrett. Mm-hmm. So Garrett, you know, says like, hey, let's do this. It'll, you know, benefit us in X, Y, and Z. And Dedrick was like, fuck yeah, let's do it. They pitched it to the Synanon board, which unanimously approved the plan. Though on one copy of Garrett's proposal, someone wrote, who will be God? A very fair question, my friend. A fair question. So basically, that's the first phase of Synanon. Curing addiction. Second phase, creating a utopian community for the middle class. Third phase, let's make money. Synanon adopted the slogan, the people business. And they really did start running it as a business. And it's so funny when they say the people business, because I think to like Michael Scott, it's like, we're not just in the paper business. We're in the people business. So by the end of 1976, Synanon had assets worth $22 million with $8 million in annual revenue, which came mostly from its specialty advertising department, which was like those pens and office supplies that just had the logo stamped on it. As well as a mortgage business one member had donated and cash contributions from Squares. Synanon owned 5,500 acres of property, including the six-story Del Mar Club in Santa Monica, which is now the Casa Del Mar Hotel, a cluster of nearby apartment buildings, three large compounds in Marin County, and another in Badger, California, which also had an airstrip, like their own private airstrip. They also had a fleet of 200 cars, 400 motorcycles, 62 freight trucks, 20 boats, and 12 airplanes, along with $1 million invested in the stock market. By 1977, Dedrick was, his annual salary was roughly $100,000, which in today's money is $400,000 a year. And he also received a $500,000 pre-retirement bonus. Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, people were still joining Synanon, even though things were starting to kind of pivot. But one thing was really clear was that you did not want to cross Charles Dedrick. When the San Francisco Examiner called Synanon the racket of the century, the organization sued, forcing the paper to pay $600,000 and run a front page apology. They also sued a local ABC station, which settled. They sued Time Magazine, which called Synanon a kooky cult in the 1977 story. So at this point, the media is trying to kind of spread the word like, hey, they're catching on. This is starting to get a little shady.
Yeah.
Reporters themselves were personally threatened. Times editor-in-chief was stopped outside of his apartment by two men with shaved heads who told him, we're going to ruin your life. And when a reporter brought this up with Dedrick, he said, I don't know what these people might do. I don't know what action they might take against the people responsible, their wives, their children. Bombs could be thrown into odd places, into the homes of some of the clowns who occupy high places in the Time organization. Just like a thinly veiled threat right there.
Right. Yeah.
They even developed their own private security force and formed a paramilitary group called the Imperial Marines. You're going to love this. They developed their own style of martial arts. Guess what it was called?
What did they call it?
Sindo.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And what was it based on? Is it based on?
I don't know if it was like actually
Taekwondo.
Probably not. I have no idea. I didn't read if it was actually based off of Taekwondo or if they're just like, ooh, martial art. Let's just have it end in do. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah.
They thought they were being very clever. They also, by 1978, had amassed a huge arsenal of guns. They had hundreds of guns. who needs guns if you're just a like religious organization or you're just trying to better people's lives? Why do you need guns?
Because they're cult.
And they would claim because they were concerned about the rising crime rate and that that's why they started these security and military groups so that they could like basically, okay, cool. So now you're vigilantes.
It's like if Al-Anon had gone down that route, if you went into any Al-Anon, or not Al-Anon, I'm sorry. I went to Al-Anon, to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you were to go there and they were armed, just in case, we're worried about you guys. Who knows who's going to come in here?
Yeah.
But it's a safe place. What the fuck?
Basically, they were like, if trouble should occur, we're prepared to handle it. Was their mm-hmm. kind of defense for starting those groups and having that much weaponry. But honestly, the increasing crime rate was probably due to Synanon. In 1975, yeah. three members admitted to assaulting a Marin County rancher. And Dedrick called them heroes. There was another rancher who was pistol whipped in Santa Monica. The Synanon followers were starting to be called like Synanites. They beat up two black couples who had parked their car at a Synanon apartment building. And Dedrick, in response to this, he was like at a press conference after these things happened. And he said, nonviolence was just a position. We can change positions anytime we want to. Like, we have the right to become violent. Do you, though?
Jesus.
Yeah, gosh, this guy loved going on the media because, again, he was very eloquent. He was a great orator. I'm going to keep using that word over and over again.
And I'm going to look up his chart. I want to know what sign he is.
So get this. The power keeps going to Dedrick's head. In 1976, Dedrick demanded that members stop having kids. So before this point, people were having kids. They would raise their families within the compounds, within the community. And at first, it was a very good place to live. Once things started going sour, and then now here, Dedrick is like, no more kids.
Okay, I just have to say, like I said earlier, that I was off. I was sick today. Mm-hmm. I didn't work. I like napped on and off all day. But in between, when I was awake, I watched another documentary on Heaven's Gate.
Oh, nice.
Where the women had to cut their hair yep. to look like men. The Parallels. Men were castrated.
Yep. One of them died from and the castration. Then
exactly. And then I also watched the first three episodes, because that's all that's out, about the Remnant Church, Gwen Shamblin.
Mm-hmm.
Another cult.
It's control. And
just
the control.
He
basically started going off in a rant, Dedrick, about like not having kids, saying that they were a very bad investment. He said, all the dummies, you, all of you, y'all just sit there, and as this organization gets richer and fatter and more fun to be in and more powerful, you love that, but you're all alike. You're all alike. You sit there, mum, when I make these speeches. I have done exactly like the rest of the guys that run the world. I could have run a state, a country, a city. It doesn't make any difference. I'm one of those guys. I know the magic.
He's an Aries, by the way.
Oh, interesting. No wonder he likes the combative therapy. So after the no children mandate, women were basically bullied, forced to have abortions. And Dedrick described it as squeezing a boil, nothing more. Abortions, like, it's a big deal.
Men, yeah, I still imagine squeezing a boil does not.
I mean, that sounds horrible. men were pressured into getting vasectomies. Actually, they Roughly about 80 operations took place in 1976 within Synanon.
Yikes.
There was endless attack sessions happening, the games, and actually mm-hmm. focused on males who refused to get vasectomies. And when they gave in, they were basically doctors waiting in the next room to give them vasectomies. So they started using their signature attack therapy, the Synanon game,
mm-hmm.
to really bully people into doing whatever Dedrick wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So remember Phil Ritter? He was the one that like got the job as a mechanic.
Right.
He was a square. So he was super disturbed by the mass sterilization. When he spoke against it in a game, he told them the general reaction was, if you don't want to do it, pack your bags. It was pretty much like, you either get a vasectomy, you sterilize yourself, or you get out of here. He was so disturbed that he actually went to the Marin County Sheriff's Office because he's like, there has to be a law against this kind of thing. And you know what? There wasn't. The authorities informed Synanon attorneys who told Ritter not to come back. He had a wife and child in Synanon. So now his wife and child are stuck in Synanon. He can't go back. Mm-hmm. And these people have guns, so it's not like he can just walk into the building.
Right.
And then the next big rule was handed down after Betty died in 1977. So people say, like, the ones that know the dynamic between Betty and Charles was that Betty was a little more sympathetic, a little more kind of understanding, and actually talked down Dedrick a lot from being so harsh. So now that she's out of the picture, things started getting intense. At this point, when she passed, Dedrick was 64, and he immediately wanted to remarry. He said, quote, "I sent up a flare like any monarch of old times would have done. I let the word out I was available." God, this guy thinks so much of himself. Of the six women who applied for being his wife, Dedrick chose Ginny Shorin, who was a 31-year-old teacher at one of Synanon's schools. So they did have, like, schools within it. Like, I mean, you know, people were raising their families. Like, it was a whole compound. They offered everything within Synanon.
Right.
And shortly after that, Dedrick decided that marriage should no longer be permanent. Couples were told to split up and form new three-year-long love matches. And within days,
like another cult. What cult did that? Honestly, there's like, another one.
They're
that
not.
Did
it's
that.
Not that original.
No, it's not.
He thinks like he's, you know, innovating all of this stuff, and it's right. Not that original. So many other cults mm-hmm. have done stuff like this. But as soon as he declared that, within days, 230 couples filed for divorce. That's the power that he had over these people. Mm-hmm. And among them was Phil Ritter's wife. Yeah. And making matters worse, Synanon restricted how often Ritter could visit their three-year-old daughter. And he filed a motion to be allowed to see her more. One day, Phil Ritter was returning home from the supermarket when two young men approached him. And without saying a word, they beat him with wooden mallets, leaving him on the ground, bleeding with a fractured skull. They didn't even take his wallet. And the attack was among at least 18 that the California Attorney General's office eventually linked to Synanon. Now, I mentioned earlier Paul Marantz. Now, he was a lawyer that went up against Synanon. This is where Paul Marantz came into the picture. So, he actually was originally like a writer. Like, he really wanted to go into journalism, but he also went to law school. So, he was really a lawyer by trade, journalist by kind of, I don't know. He was like journalist turned lawyer, I guess. Mm-hmm. He first sued Synanon in 1977 on behalf of Francis and Ed Wynn, who claimed that Frances had been kidnapped, brainwashed, and tortured by the group for purposes of financial gain, despite her emotional instability. So basically, Frances was really mentally ill, and she was at home. She wasn't doing well. It was kind of, she was having an episode. She called her husband, Ed. And Ed told her, like, you know, he's like, I'm on my way. Like, go to the hospital, pretty much. Like, she was getting suicidal. He's like, go to the hospital. The hospital sent her to Synanon. Because Synanon is so great in rehabilitating people. Yeah. So he basically took him up to court for that. Like, you know, she... So she arrived there. They shaved her head. They wouldn't release her. It was really scary. So like when Ed, the husband, found out that Synanon, you know, that's where she ended up. Okay, so she ended up in a facility in Tamales Bay. I'm laughing because, not because this is funny, like, this is just, I can't imagine. So within minutes of walking through the doors, she was shaved. Her head was shaved. She was screamed at a game. She was told her husband didn't want her. This is a woman who's already emotionally unstable and was on the verge of psychosis. And she was told that only Synanon could help. She was told that the Tamales Bay compound, that this was her new home. And Ed had no idea where she was at this point. And when he finally tracked her down, he went to visit her. He was informed that he couldn't see her for 90 days. And so he knew that something was up, Ed. And so that's when he reached out to the lawyer, Paul Marantz. And when Ed told his story, Marantz was like, whoa, this sounds fishy as fuck. He actually had a contact in the Department of Public Health and asked what Synanon was licensed for. The voice on the other end of the phone was like, it basically whispered into the phone, Synanon is not licensed. He's like, how? What do you mean?
No one else called that out.
What do you mean it's not licensed? And the contact said, we don't understand it either, and they don't let us in. So back in the 60s, when Synanon was charged with running a hospital without a license, Governor Pat Brown signed a law clarifying that Dederick's brand of drug treatment wasn't medical care per se and didn't need a license. But the bill didn't specify anything about treating mental illness, which meant Synanon could be in trouble for taking in Frances and trying to manipulate her and use their tactics on her. Marantz pressured Synanon to release her. And when he and Edwin went to pick her up, they saw a sea of people with shaved heads and overalls just silently smiling at them.
Ew.
Creepy. Ugh, just like creepy. Icky. At that point, Marantz could tell there was something seriously wrong with this place. He said, I had a sense that everything in the 31 years of my life that had happened previously was all pointed towards this moment, this time, that this was going to be the test that I think I always wanted to have. And Marantz effectively declared war on Synanon that day. And, you know, Synanon was up to the task. You want to go to war? Let's do it. Rumor had it that Dederick could be heard over Synanon's private radio network ranting, who is this guy Marantz? Why doesn't someone break his legs? And
they had their own radio.
They had, like, they had everything. They literally were in a bubble. They provided everything for these people to not need the outside world.
This man, had he been around today, would first he'd He was Joe Rogan.
So what is beneficial later on is that Charles Dederich was kind of obsessed with recording himself all the time. And there was a recording of a speech that was eventually seized by the LAPD, where Dederich said, quote, "We are not going to mess with the old time, turn the other cheek religious posture. We're going to, our religious posture is, don't mess with us. You can get killed, dead, physically dead. We either have a good thing here or we don't. If we have a good thing here, then we are not going to permit people like greedy lawyers to destroy it," end quote. Yikes. There is disagreement over whether Dederich actually ordered, like directly ordered, the attack by Synanon members on Paul Morantz, which I'll get into what happened, or if he just kind of encouraged it and then that the members took it into their own hands.
Even if they took it into their own hands, it's his bag.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. So here's what happened to Paul. He basically set out to warn the world about Synanon. And on behalf of Francis and Ed Wynn, he started a legal battle with Synanon. And he grew scared because he then realized kind of the right. violence that this group was capable of. And he figured that his name was on Dederich's hit list. He started getting threatening phone calls at all hours of the night. But what really concerned him was when the threats just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So he went and bought a shotgun. He was looking over his shoulder the whole time, like all the time. He'd check under his car for...
get a shotgun?
Well, I mean... he wanted to protect himself.
Yeah, you get a handgun. I mean, it's much quicker. Right?
Yeah, that's interesting, huh? Shotgun.
Yeah.
Maybe if he saw them coming from far away, just, you know.
And that's the only way they're going to get him from far away.
But yeah, the poor guy, he was checking his car for bombs before getting in. Mm. He was just constantly just so, like, the hypervigilance that you must have to think that you're being targeted. Like, I get it. I haven't been through the same thing, but I've had instances where I've had to be hyper vigilant, and it sucks and it's exhausting. Mm. So he lived in Pacific Palisades, and one night when he's returning home on the evening of October 11th, 1977, he was actually really excited to get home and relax over game one of the World Series and watch that on TV. It was the Dodgers versus the Yankees. He says, "For one moment, I'm not going to think about Synanon. I'm just going to watch the baseball game." He got home and he walked over to the mail slot by his front door. Through the grill of the mailbox, he sees a weirdly shaped package. It's hard to tell without his glasses. He thinks maybe it's like a curled up scarf. He does not remember much until the pain of the rattlesnake sinking its fangs into him hit him. Okay. Like, he didn't even realize what was happening until like the pain. They had put a rattlesnake in his mailbox and they had removed the rattler so that he wouldn't hear the rattlesnake. He was, obviously, he needed a medical attention immediately. He actually, the way that he recalls it, he suddenly started hearing a scream, but then later realized that it was his own scream. Like, it was, like, everything happened so quickly. Mm-hmm. Like, one of those kind of instances where he just didn't realize that.
Right.
Where that pain was coming from, it, like, very slowly, everything kind of came together. The snake was 4.5 feet. It's obviously after it bit his hand, it kind of dropped to the floor and recoiled. Morantz ran out the door and he was yelling, "Call the police, call an ambulance. I've been bitten by a rattlesnake. It's Synanon. Synanon got me." So word of the attack quickly went national. News anchor mm-hmm. Walter Cronkite called it bizarre, even by cult standards. Just kind of funny. It's not funny that it happened, but it's right. It is like, who came up with that?
Yeah.
Of all the ways that you can try to take someone out. So after this whole attack went down, obviously there were like depositions and stuff. So they're trying to figure out basically what happened, mm-hmm. who ordered this hit. Former Synanon attorney Philip Burdett insisted that Dederick did not obviously order the hit directly on Morantz. But there were three declarations written in 1983 by three Synanon officials in exchange for immunity from prosecution, which stated that Imperial Marines prepared a hit list of Synanon enemies that was approved by Dederick's assistant, Walter Lubell. And the hit list included former Synanon president Jack Hurst, whose guard dog was found hanged, Phil Ritter, and Paul Morantz. And they alleged that Security Chief Art Warfield had directed Imperial Marine Joe Musico, who was, by the way, a Vietnam vet, to find a hitman to kill Morantz. When Musico reported the job would cost $10,000 for whoever he had to contact of the hitman, that's going to be 10 grand. Synanon executives were like, we're not, that's too high. We're a multi-million dollar business, but $10,000 is too high. And they directly ordered the Marines to take care of Morantz themselves. In a following deposition, Dederick claimed to have a very dim memory of 1977 due to a series of strokes. But he said most of what Synanon did in 1977, at least what I knew about, I approved of because I pointed out before over and over again, I'm one hell of a good executive and not too much ever went on in the organization that I ran that I didn't approve of. I don't know everything that went on, of course. So which one is it? Do you know everything or do you not?
Right.
He's like, yeah, no, mm-hmm. I'm the chief. I know everything that's going on. I'm in charge of everything. Nothing gets by me, but some things get by me.
Yeah.
So according to the declarations, Lubell, the assistant, was the one who directed Musico and Alan Hubbard to attack Phil Ritter. And Lubell, who ordered Musico and Lance Kenton, the son of jazz musician Stan Kenton, to travel to Los Angeles and plant the rattlesnake in Morantz's mailbox. The day after the attack, police arrested Musico and Kenton. A month later, Los Angeles prosecutor John Watson and 30 law enforcement officials basically descended on Synanon's new $1 million compound in Lake Havasu to arrest Dederick on the charge of conspiracy to commit murder. They found him in a stupor, staring straight ahead, an empty bottle of Chivas Regal in front of him. So he was drunk. He was so drunk that he had to be carried out by stretcher to jail.
Of course he was.
Yeah. In 1980, Dederick pleaded no contest to conspiracy to commit murder. He was fined $10,000, sentenced to 5 years of probation. Morantz agreed to let Dederick avoid prison time because of his poor health. Dederick wasn't doing too well. And he was barred from having any affiliation with Synanon. And of course, once you chop off the head, Synanon floundered. The IRS revoked its...
I thought you were going to be like, three heads popped out.
Three heads popped out. No, not like Cerberus. no, like the... Yeah, they lost their leader. They lost their fearless leader. And so it fell apart at that point. The IRS revoked its tax-exempt status and ordered Synanon to pay $17 million. In the lengthy court battle that ensued, Morantz provided hundreds of documents that he'd found that implicated Dederick and other Synanon officials in criminal acts. And those documents became the foundation of Morantz's book on Synanon, From Miracle to Madness. So if you want to give that a read, go ahead. I haven't read it, I'll have to say, but I would love to read it someday. The court finally ruled against Synanon in 1984, finding that it had a policy of terror and violence and a practice of diverting corporate resources for the enrichment of individuals. Synanon declared bankruptcy and in 1991 formally dissolved, though a branch actually is still running to this day in Germany.
Really?
Yeah. Phil Ritter eventually reunited with his wife and daughter after they left Synanon in 1978. And Morantz still lives in Pacific Palisades. He is in his 70s. He has neuropathy, arthritis, and a blood disease that he believes are from the snake bite attack.
Mm.
And he says, quote, "I'm going to set the record for the longest murder ever," unquote. Just because after that attack, he's just had like a slew of ailments and
right.
He's just not doing well. After being convicted, Dedrick moved with his wife, Jenny, into a double-wide mobile home in Visalia. He died in 1997, a few weeks shy of his 84th birthday. And he was saluted on the floor of the House of Representatives by Beria Congressman and future Oakland Mayor Ron Dellums.
For what?
Like, saluted, like, oh, he died. Like, he thought he was so great.
Men are like, so dumb.
Dedrick distinguished himself in the area of drug rehabilitation and amassed great wealth before his organization was associated with violence and tax problems, is Dellums' defense.
Because it was a cult!
Mm-hmm. His approach to rehabilitating drug addicts has become a major paradigm for drug recovery and therapeutic communities the world over, which weirdly has a trace of truth in it.
But all cults have that to some degree. Like when I covered Nexium, it started as they offered something, I forget the term now, but they claimed they could treat Tourette's. And like that's huge, I remember that. Right? Yeah. But like,
and
not
they had
really.
This like innovative artificial intelligence is what they called it. Do you remember that part where they like called it artificial intelligence, but it was really like their just like psychological tactic? I don't know. It was really weird. It wasn't like a robot or anything, but they use the term artificial intelligence. I remember that like striking me really weird.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of cults tend to start out with something that they swear works. The one I just watched, Gwen, I could be wrong about her name, Gwen Shamblin. She ran a church, but her jig was losing weight through God. And people were losing weight, but they had eating disorders. So Yikes. It's like, it works, but there's a big but.
You know, it's so funny. I realized that I said like, "Ooh, this is gonna be quick," and I don't know why I thought it would be quick, but I have been talking. I think we're like an hour 20 into the podcast, so I guess it's a good thing that yours is a shorter one. This one ended up being longer. I don't know, like I just got into it, man. I got into this actually because I'm a huge fan of And That's Why We Drink, which is another great podcast, and theirs is like purely kind of like this kind of episode format where they cover true crime and paranormal. And while they didn't cover Synanon, they covered a story related to Synanon, and then they started like kind of mentioning it. And I'm like, well, that sounds interesting. They covered the Elan School in Maine, which was founded by a former Synanon member that used those same Synanon tactics, the attack therapy. The combative like group sessions. And that ended with its own true crime story.
Of course it did.
Yeah. So anyways, that is my story. I just found it so interesting too, because when I found out that they had so much property in Marin County, I'm like, how have I lived just north of Marin County for most of my life? And I've never heard of this group. And I've been enthralled in true crime for years, like many, many of us here. I don't know. Like, it's just one of those things where I just hadn't heard of it until I heard about it on another podcast. And then I started kind of listening to episodes about Synanon, and I'm like, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
So, anywho, your turn.
Okay, like I said, mine's a bit shorter, and it, of course, starts with a touch of true crime-ish.
Fun.
I feel like most of the time they do. No, of course not. It has a few different names. There's the cursed chair, the death chair, dead man's chair.
Oh, I'm so excited. I've heard of this.
But the Busby's chair, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So, who is Busby? His full name was Thomas Busby. He was a thug, thief, and drunkard who lived in North Yorkshire in the latter part of the 1600s. Super long ago. And starting in the late 1600s, a local man named Daniel Oddie happily committed several crimes for the sake of his family's survival, some of which were theft of jewelry, counterfeiting currency, etc. throughout the city. Daniel Oddie and Thomas Busby linked up and they're like, let's do this together. For some reason, they became friends. And they became so close that Busby actually married Elizabeth, who was Daniel Oddie's daughter.
Oh.
Yeah. So they weren't the same age.
Okay.
There was an age difference, but still. I don't actually.
You know, love is love.
Right.
I'm not saying that, like, huge age gaps can't work, but it's always kind of odd.
Especially when you're like, this is my business partner. Hey, yo, your daughter. She's kind of cute. Let me marry that.
So it's more of a crazy stupid love kind of situation. Have you ever seen that movie?
No. I was just going to say, is that a movie reference?
Yes, Crazy Stupid Love. So it has Steve Carell and Ryan Gosling. And Steve Carell is like a recent divorcee. And Ryan Gosling is this, I don't know, like stud womanizer. Kind of not woman, I don't know. He's got game, and they meet, and he's like, I'm gonna help you find your manhood and make you cool again so that your wife wants you back. It's interesting, while Steve Carell's character starts becoming a ladies' man, Ryan Gosling meets this woman he starts falling in love with and ends his ladies' man life, and then skip 30 seconds ahead if you haven't seen this movie and you don't want the twist to be whatever, but at this point I'm sure you can guess. She ends up being Steve Carell's daughter, unknowingly. So anyways, that's what I was referring to. It's a great film. It's super cute, super funny. Also has Julianne Moore in it. Great actors in it. And not Emma Watson, oh my gosh, Emma Stone.
Okay. You know, this is, I think, far less romantic.
I'm sure.
And they helped each other out more in a coin counterfeiting business sort of way.
Fun.
That was their main thing. Okay. That's what they like to do together.
All right.
So they got into business. They were doing that. Busby married his daughter. We know that. So Oddie also, he purchased a farm after moving to the area, and his house, which he called Denoti Hall, something like that. It was like the perfect house for him. It enabled him to continue with his coining activities in seclusion. So he didn't have to worry about being found out or anything. And it was actually reported that Oddie had built within the house a hidden chamber, which was connected to the cellar via a secret passageway.
Oh.
So Busby. I love
secret passageways.
Well, I feel like it's necessary when you're a criminal.
Yeah, so I feel like it's really like setting up the story for some real pizzazz.
Really set him up for good business, for secrecy. So Busby, who was also the original owner of an inn near the town of Sandhutton and just 3 miles away, I don't know why I word it like that. He bought a house not too far away.
Oh, okay.
They live near each other.
Gotcha.
What happened on this one particular day, though, is a little vague because it's the 1600s.
Gotcha.
You know, no one was recording this. It's reported that they may have argued earlier that day, but it's not really known what they argued over. Okay. I assume when you're in the criminal business, there's probably plenty of things to argue over, semantics over who does what. Mm-hmm. But it could have been something to do with Elizabeth or the business. Not really sure.
Yeah, just something happened. Yeah. Sticky happened.
Their relationship to that point had been known to be very far from harmonious.
Oh.
Because Busby was often in a foul mood with Audie for one reason or another. And it was on him. He was always the one in a bad mood. Audie, not so much. The one thing that is for sure about this particular day is that Busby was quite drunk and quite volatile.
Oh, okay.
And he returned home to his inn only to find that Audie was waiting for him, threatening to take Elizabeth home with him.
Oh.
And that's why some people are like, was she involved in their argument? Like, why is he threatening to take her away?
Right.
So Busby's mood just blackened when he saw Audie sitting in his favorite chair. For some reason, that was it for him. It was like, fuck that. And he just, that's when the volatile behavior really kind of escalated.
Oh.
Busby then forcibly removed Audie from the chair and threw him out of the house. Because, like, you don't sit in his chair. Sheldon in his spot, Busby in his chair, same thing.
Yeah. A line was drawn.
Very much so. That night, Busby was still seething. He was still thinking about whatever the fuck got him so mad. He grabbed a hammer, stormed over to Danity Hall, and bludgeoned Audie to death.
Whoa.
Oof. Just straight to the point.
The word bludgeon always immediately gives me chills. It's just such a brutal word in and of itself. Bludgeon. Oof.
It is. You know what word gets me is exsanguinate.
Oh, yeah, that one too.
It's a beautiful but like piercing feel. Like,
yes. Very emotive.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I like that word a lot. Anyway, so after he killed him, he then tried to hide the body in the woods. He was like, I don't want anyone to find out that I did this. Drug him out into the woods. But obviously people became concerned over his sudden disappearance. They were criminals, yes, and he lived in seclusion, but like he was still a member of society. People still knew him.
They noticed. So where he at?
Exactly. So there was basically a local search was put into place. People came together and they started looking just to see. I think they kind of had an assumption, you know, something happened to him if he just disappeared. So they did find him. They found his body. And I think because it was known that Busby was drunk and volatile that night, I'm assuming Elizabeth may have said something. Mm-hmm. He was arrested right away.
Okay.
This wasn't like some big drawn out thing. They found suspect him on the body.
Yeah.
He was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And he was charged. So in the summer of 1702, Busby was tried and sentenced to death for the murder. Again, very quick to the point.
All right.
His punishment was to be gibbeted.
What is that?
Yeah, I had to look this up. I don't want to say I like it. It's new, so I like it. But it's when you're hung from a gibbet, which is essentially like a post. Like if you look at an old school like signpost where you got a post that goes straight up, the post that goes out that you would like hang the sign from, and then there's like the supporting post right there. It's being hung from that.
So that's a gibbet? Is that that's kind of gibbet. Style of post?
Yeah. Specifically for this, I guess. And usually they'd be hung upside down. But him specifically was going to be hung from the gibbet. His body was to be dipped in tar and his remains displayed on a stoop attached to the gibbet in full view of his inn.
Whoa.
So, like, right outside his house.
Oh, my God.
So that happened. He died, and the inn was soon after renamed the Busby Stoop Inn.
Oh, wow.
It actually kept that name up until 2012.
Oh, wow. What is it now?
I can't remember. It might actually be in my notes.
400 years? It's you just decided to notes. Change it?
Well, okay. And that's what I'll get into now as to why I think that it got changed. Gotcha. So that's all like historical. There's documents to show what occurred, that there was a murder, that he was tried. Mm-hmm. Like, we have proof of all that. From here, obviously, we go into the paranormal, so a little less historical. So one version of this is that Busby was granted his last wish before being hung by the gibbet. His wish was to have one final drink at his own inn and in his favorite, his chair, his spot.
His chair.
Okay. That's what he wanted. On leaving the inn to make his final journey to the execution site, you know, out the front door, he apparently or supposedly cursed the chair, declaring that death would shortly come to anyone who sat in it. Another version says that he just drunkenly shouted out the curse whilst being taken to the gibbet to be hung. So, like, not too different. One's a little more graceful than the other. Yeah. I mean, if he had a fine, I doubt if one drink got him drunk if he was a drunkard, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think he was allowed any other drinks, so I don't understand how he would be drunk. I don't know. Anyway, he let out a curse. Someone quoted him as saying, "May sudden death come to anyone who dare sit in my chair."
Oh, end quote. Wow.
Yeah.
Ooh, I just got chills. Again. Okay.
He said it. So whichever way you look at it, he was determined that even from beyond the grave, no one would ever sit in his spot, his chair. Wow. Now, Busby's spirit was believed to have haunted his old inn, which became a pub, as well as the area where he was gibbeted. But it's his chair that the focus of his curse really became the thing.
Mm-hmm.
According to local legend, the seemingly innocuous piece of furniture has been responsible for more deaths than most serial killers.
What?
Supposedly.
I was going to say that's one quite estimate. The number.
It is. But one estimate puts the number of its victims at over 60.
Well, I guess over 400 years.
Right.
You'd rack up some victims.
Exactly. So wow. The first reported death alleged to be associated with the his chair is that of a chimney sweep who, along with a friend, sat in the chair whilst having a drink one evening in 1894. So sometime later.
Uh-huh.
The chimney sweep never made it home that night. Being completely inebriated, he laid down on the road to sleep. The next morning, his butt, which... on a random moment reminds me of Darren. I don't know if you've had that experience with Darren when he drinks.
Oh, and he'll sleep in random places, like the Taco Bell, like the bush next to the drive-through Taco Bell for his 30th birthday.
Right out front of front door. Yeah. The house, there was a party. One time it was under the dishwasher. The dishwasher door was opened.
Uh-huh.
And he thus lay underneath.
Let me tell you, Darren is one of my favorite people drunk. One time when I was super drunk and we actually had made it back from the bars back to my place. And like we're all hanging out, all his friends, and I am like, I am not gone, but I'm done. Like I'm very, very intoxicated. And I'm just it's also very sweet because he was like trying to take care of me, but he just like he's like, I know what's going to make you feel better. You're not going to have a hangover tomorrow. And he forces me, like he force feeds me peanut butter and just straight pickle juice. And swears by it. And as much as I love both those ingredients individually together, wasn't great. You can guess the ending of that. But It was like, the fats are going to soak up the alcohol in your stomach and the minerals or whatever, the sodium and the minerals and the brine, blah, blah, blah.
The hydration. I mean, honestly, he's not super wrong with the pickle juice. It's really good for hydration.
Yeah. And the next day, I'm like, Darren, like, was that something that you used? He's like, I don't know. I just kind of pulled that out of my ass. I just didn't want to see you throw up, but then it made you throw up.
We used to have this thing when we'd go out drinking where if he found my phone sitting out, he would update my Facebook status to something that made absolutely no sense whatsoever.
He is one of the funniest people I know. I can only imagine.
Yeah. They come up super randomly. There was one.
Oh, like in your memories? I don't
know. Yeah. Lately, it's like every now and then I'm like, oh, yeah, we had a good run.
Oh my God. Meanwhile, my memories, like apparently, what was it? Like 7 years ago, I had a huge run where I would just quote stupid song lyrics for all of my statuses on Facebook. Oh God, I was annoying. Like I keep seeing them because I keep getting like 7 years ago and like every other week I updated it to something else. God.
Mine that is the most frequent thing that I would post was not feeling good, is feeling sick, is tired. Like, God, this is going on a long time.
Oh my God. Yeah. Let me tell you something. The lyrics of Dance Dance by Fall Out Boy, not as meaningful to me now as I thought it was back then. Or I really loved quoting Revolution, too. That was another one. I'm like, oh, wow, these people are poets. And if I post this, it's like, I'm a poet. Anywho.
I think I did quote Pink Floyd a couple times.
Well, I mean, come on, Pink Floyd.
And Garth.
But do you remember when everyone was quoting, can we pretend that airplanes in the night sky are like shooting stars? That was one, like, when I was in high school, like, senior year or something, I think everyone was quoting that in their Facebook status. I'm like, oh, my God. Everyone. Anywho. Wow. Memory lane.
Well, okay. Let me go back to the death.
I guess we'll get back to the story.
Let's see. Okay, yeah, so he laid down to go to sleep. He pulled a Darren. However, the next morning, his body was found hanging from the post next to the gibbet. So,
what?
Yeah, his death was ruled a suicide, but in 1914, the friend with whom the chimney sweep had spent the last hours with admitted on his deathbed to having robbed and murdered his friend.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
Yeah.
He did meet sudden death after sitting in it. So.
A curse does not mean you just mysteriously die. It just means that you die.
You die.
Yep. During the Second World War, the pub became a popular spot with RCAF airmen. The Royal something Air Force.
Committee. Ass farts. Royal Committee of Ass Farts.
It's gonna bother me to not know what that C stands for, but I know it's the Royal something. Royal Canadian Air Force.
Oh, that's not there as we fun. Go.
But no, they would go there quite frequently. And their thing was to like goad each other to sit in the chair. To be like, I dare you to sit in the chair.
I knew there was going to be at least one story of dumb people daring each other.
But because they're drinking. Ugh. Of course they are.
Oh, yeah.
Men drinking. Mm. So those that took up the challenge never returned from the missions that they went on after.
Oh, my God. Stop. Oof.
Yeah.
So many chills over here.
Oof. Which, you know, you can keep in mind. This was during World War II.
Yeah.
So.
There was a lot of death
that did occur. Yeah.
It is war. Yeah.
But fast forward to 1968, a couple of years before Tony Earnshaw took over running the pub, he overheard two airmen dare each other to sit in the chair. They both did. And returning to the airfield, their car left the road and crashed into a tree. And they both died on the way to the hospital.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So no war to blame there. And through the early 1970s, the chair seemed to claim a number of victims, including a cleaning lady who was diagnosed with a brain tumor after knocking into the chair.
What? She didn't even sit in it.
Just knocked into it. It's a spot. Oh, a number of cyclists and motorcyclists who suffered fatal road accidents. A hitchhiker who was run over after having spent two nights at the pub. And a local man who died of a heart attack shortly after sitting in the chair. So those are other reports. A group of builders having a drink at the pub kind of, again, goaded the youngest of their group into sitting in the chair. And then back at the site, the man fell through the roof of the building and landed on the concrete ground below.
Oh, my God.
And after that death, Tony Earnshaw, who finally took it over, he banished the chair to the cellar and was like, no, I don't want any more deaths connected with this thing.
Honestly, I'm surprised it took them so long. Gosh.
Yeah. Now, it's in the cellar, but a delivery man from the brewery went down into the cellar one day and decided, like, fuck it, I'll be to sit in it. He commented to Tony Earnshaw that it was far too comfortable to be left down there. And then he was killed shortly afterwards when his van went off the road.
That poor guy. He's like, I was just trying to take a break. I've been lifting heavy things. Oh, look, a chair. Awesome sauce. Oh.
And then he died.
Wow.
So
and he was even like, let's put it back to his illustrious place. And Busby was still like, off with your head.
Yeah, a curse is forever, man.
Like diamonds.
Yes. So soon after, Earnshaw must have decided that the chair would be a profitable tourist attraction, but was too dangerous to keep. So he donated it in 1978 to the Thirsk Museum. And that museum is still open and functioning today with the chair in place as of December 2014. Though it is now up, like, on a wall, so no one can sit on it.
Oh, smart.
Yeah, no one can get
to
it.
I was going to say, like, why don't you, like, put, like, encase it in glass? Like, put, like, glass all around it so people can't sit in it.
Right. Money. Just need two nails and get it on the wall.
That's true.
It's said that for some time prior to death, that the person who sat in the chair would experience things like extreme itching, paranoia, hearing things, confusion, and then experience items being moved and written warnings on mirrors and walls about the person's imminent death, in addition to other strange happenings. So that's not, there aren't as many stories, especially since, you know, this all kind of ended in the 70s. Nothing's happened since then with the chair.
Okay.
I looked into it a little bit further because I was looking at the chair and I was like, is this really the original chair? After all this time, is that the original chair? There are reports that it is.
Chair. Okay.
There are also reports that it's not. So at this point, who knows if it really is. I think the museum has something to, like, try and authenticate it. So there is probably a good chance that it is. And also looking into it a bit further, there have been all kinds of, like, petitions to have it burned in a bonfire that went nowhere. Like change.org. People literally tried to get rid of this chair. But it's on a wall, so it can't do anything. Actually, it's on a hook.
Oh, yeah. It's on a hook. I was seeing... Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not as decrepit as you would think a 400-year-old chair would look like, but they did make things to last back then. Nothing like the China-built stuff that you get nowadays.
Exactly. So it's you know, who knows for sure.
That's a chair that Ron Swanson would be proud of.
Absolutely. He would. Now, that really is kind of all there is to the story. Like I said, it's super short. I did briefly also look up just like, you know, he cursed this chair. Is there anything I can share about like curses in general that obviously goes mm-hmm. into a bit of like a witchy realm? But it's a curse really is just any expressed wish that some form of adversity or misfortune will befall or attach to one or more persons, a place, or an object. So pretty broad. Oh. And that's exactly what he did. If he said that in any shape or form, that would absolutely be a curse.
Wow. Wow, wow. Oh, I've definitely heard the story of this chair, but it's been a while. That is so funny. That's like kind of ingenious that they put it up on the wall mm-hmm. so that no one can sit on it anymore.
Right. But then I wonder. There. I heard of this in an old episode of Unsolved Mysteries.
Ah, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Oh, good one, Laura. That's like such a unique story.
Super short. Isn't it?
Chair.
I feel like if I hadn't seen that on Unsolved Mysteries, I never would have heard about it.
Yeah. Like, who thinks to Google, like, haunted chairs?
Right?
Love that.
Cursed. That's... Cursed.
Cursed chair. Yeah, right. It's more cursed than haunted. Although it sounds like some people were starting to get haunted after the curse took effect.
Right.
Oh, man. Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode, everybody. And we, again, thank you for your understanding for kind of our irregular month. We had to skip last week, and we were having some technical difficulties mm-hmm. The other day, so we couldn't get this out on Wednesday. It'll have to come out Thursday or possibly Wednesday night, depending on how quickly I can get to editing this thing. But... yeah, because I'm like, it is Wednesday, the day that this is supposed to have come out. I could maybe just mm-hmm. like try to edit this and get it published as soon as I can. But we're going to make this short and sweet because Laura and I are both ready for bed.
Yeah.
So thank you, everybody. We bid you a good night, no matter what time of day you're listening to this. We're saying good night. Adieu. Adieu. We'll catch you next week for our witchy episode. We mentioned Patreon earlier in this episode. Check us out on patreon.com/thenewwitches if you're interested in supporting the podcast. Other ways to support the podcast, follow us on social media. We are at The New Witches. If you'd like to submit for listener story, April listener stories is coming up. That's every 13th of mm-hmm. the month. We read out your stories and questions. To submit your listener submission, go to our website, thenewwitches.com, and go to our contact page. We have a submission form there, or you can email it in directly to us at thenewwitches@gmail.com. And lastly, you can also call it in, which is really fun because then we actually feature the recording of your voice on the podcast. You're famous. You have up to 3 minutes to leave your voicemail. When you call this number, it goes straight to voicemail. You don't have to talk to anybody. The phone number is 707-559-8111. And other ways to support the podcast, let me think. Rate and review us, please and thank you. If the listening platform that you're using so allows it, because I know not you can't rate and review on every single platform, but Spotify, Apple mm-hmm. Podcasts, please rate and review us. It really does help not only to better our like viewership or listenership, I should say. But it also helps us know what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. We appreciate constructive criticism. And what else? Yeah, that's it. Catch us next week. Stay witchy.
Keep it creepy.
Bye.
Bye.